Hello to all our listeners and welcome to another episode of the INSS podcast series. My name is Michal Chatuel-Radoshitsky and I'm a research fellow here at INSS. The month of May marks a very special milestone in Israel's history, acquiring state membership status in the UN. In light of this momentous occasion, with me in the studio today is UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process and Envoy of the UN Secretary General to the Quartet, Mr. Nikolai Mladenov. In his last posting, Mr. Mladenov served as the UN Special Representative to Iraq, and before that, he served as the Minister of Foreign Affairs and Minister of Defense of Bulgaria. Importantly to this context, Mr. Mladenov has played a key role in negotiating the current ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. Thank you very much for joining us on the show.
It's good to be here.
So, Israel joined the UN in May 1949, when Israel had 1 million citizens and the UN had 59 member states. Fast forward 70 years, and today, Israel has 9 million citizens and the UN has 193 member states. To my opinion, the joining of more and more states to the UN illustrates the importance related to the UN by these international players who want to play a role in international processes. But having said that, there's also criticism that during these 70 years, the UN has not changed its operational procedures and has failed to keep pace with global changes in diplomacy. For example, if we take the UN Security Council veto, the mechanism which really debilitates this very important body. What do you say to critics that argue that the UN is becoming less and less relevant?
Well, I don't think the UN is becoming relevant, although I do think that the UN is well overdue for some serious reforms. And these reforms may need to start at the Security Council and go all the way down to how the rest of the UN family functions. But it hasn't outlived its usefulness by far. The fact that you hear often about conflicts that have not been resolved by the United Nations means that you don't hear a lot about other conflicts that have been resolved in the United Nations, because usually, because of the dynamics in the Security Council, conflict areas that get most attention are the ones in which the Security Council is divided or politicized. Syria, for example, the Israeli-Palestinian question, others. But there are many, many other parts in the world where the UN has actually done very good work in preventive diplomacy and de-escalating tensions and preventing war, or in helping countries rebuild after natural disasters or man-made conflicts. Where I'd like to see actually change happen is in the bureaucracy of the UN, which is quite substantial. I'd like to see the organization much more flexible in how we react to situations on the ground and the tools that we have at our disposal to actually prevent conflicts and work in conflict situations. Most of our tools were designed in a different era, in the middle of the Cold War, after the end of the Second World War. The world has moved on quite dramatically since then. If you just think of one very basic concept, the UN was set up to deal with conflicts between countries, between states. And now most of the conflicts that we need to deal with are actually within states, between different armed groups or proxies of other states, etc. So there's definitely a need of a new toolbox in that respect. But to get that type of reform, you need agreement in the Security Council and in the General Assembly. The current Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has been very vocal on a number of things, one of which is the focus on our need to work better in preventive diplomacy, not to wait for a conflict to happen, but to do everything that we can in advance to prevent it. And I think our work here in Gaza is a good example of that. Or on using new technologies, social media, etc., as part of our tools. I think these are new fields that we need to really, as the United Nations, explore much more actively. The veto in the Security Council is one aspect of how the Security Council functions that is quite dramatic. Many in Israel will feel that Israel has benefited vastly from this veto. Others will be very critical of the fact that particularly discussions on the Israeli-Palestinian file have been vetoed within the Security Council. But this has happened in other files. My UN experience started in Iraq in a way, and one of the defining differences between dealing with the situation in Iraq and dealing with the situation here in terms of the work of the Security Council was that in the Security Council there was full unanimity on supporting what we were doing in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And that meant that when we needed the Council to speak out on certain issues or to authorize certain operations, they were very willing to do it. Because there was full agreement that we needed to deal with Daesh in 2014 to support the Iraqi state in restarting its institutions, elections, etc. Here it's quite different because when I report to the Security Council and we have closed discussions, I feel that actually we have, if not full unanimity, quite a lot of support for we're doing on the ground. We have, in fact, we have full support for what we're doing on the ground, but it's difficult to get public statements and reactions in the Council. And this is, in a way, this hinders sometimes our work. I wouldn't say always. Sometimes it does. But also from an Israeli perspective, there have been so many UN resolutions, so many statements, declarations, what have you, that at one point, we might be better off left to do our work rather than to focus on producing more statements.
So I'll focus exactly on that last point. If you look at the National Security Index, which the INSS published earlier this year, 47% of Israelis believe that the entire world is against us. Now, if you look at all the UN activities, what the Israeli public discourse will focus on is not all the positive things that you've mentioned vis-a-vis Iraq and Syria and other states, but on the fact that, for example, last week, the World Health Organization Assembly, which convened on May 22nd, singled out Israel as a violator of human rights, of health rights. On Clause 7 of the UN Human Rights Council, which is biased to Israel. On the fact that even the UN Security Council that you've mentioned has separate monthly meetings to address the Middle East and the Palestinian question. What do you tell these Israelis who cite UN bias to Israel in substantiating the claim that everyone hates us, the world is against us?
Well, sorry to disappoint, but you're not unique in thinking that the whole world is against you, at least those 47% of you that think that. If you look at the last European election, quite a lot of people in Europe also fear the rest of the world, and that's very, very unfortunate. I think that one needs to understand that the UN is not a monolithic body. It is a it is very different things. It is the politics between the member states, which govern the General Assembly, the governing bodies of organizations like the WHO, UNESCO, UNICEF, the Human Rights Council, where the politics of these states play out. These are how decisions there are taken, often is by block voting. Certainly, you know, if we go back to Kofi Annan, when he was Secretary General of the UN, he was very open about the fact that there's a disproportionate focus on the, on Israel,
and
Israel is being singled out after
well.
Him, mm-hmm. Ban Ki-moon, and certainly Antonio Guterres now. But that is the result of the politics between member states. So that's one side of the UN. There's a different side of the UN, which is what the Secretary General does, the political missions, myself, others like me, around the world. And our mandate then stems either from Security Council resolutions, which say we expect you to do the following things in a conflict area. Iraq had such a resolution, for example. There's one on Syria and other conflict, Libya, etc. Or more flexible mandates, like the one I have here, which is not enshrined in a Security Council resolution, but it is created as an office to support the peace process and work with both sides towards achieving their goals. So there's the member state side of the United Nations, there's the Secretary General side of the United Nations, and then there's the agencies, the funds and the programs that are actually working on the ground, humanitarian work, development work, etc. The monthly briefings that you mentioned are quite unique. I've tried to dig in and find out what's the genesis of these monthly briefings to the Security Council. Apparently, it started quite a long time ago when, if you looked at the situation in the Middle East, the only thing to talk about was the Palestinian question because everything was frozen. Then everything started coming apart, but the briefing stayed there. I believe that these briefings need to, particularly not, I mean, they're every month, every third month. The briefing is called an open debate, which means that all member states of the UN can come in and speak about everything. I've always tried to not only discuss the Palestinian question, but try and open it up to include what's happening in Lebanon and Syria, other parts of the Middle East. On some occasions, this has been successful, and we looked at cross-border issues, whether that's terrorism or whether that's the rights of children and women, etc. But member states are quite conservative in how they approach these things. The usefulness, however, of these briefings is that not so much in the public part of the briefing, but it is in the closed session that usually follows, the closed consultations that follow the briefing, in which I basically sit down with the member states of the Security Council and we discuss openly and off the record what's happening on the ground. And I think in the briefings that we provide, we always try to be very fact-based on what's happening on all sides of the arguments, present the different challenges that we're dealing with, and basically help the member states and the Security Council understand what's going on the ground. Now, what decisions they take, if any, on the basis of these briefings, that's not in our hands.
Yeah, certainly. So when you spoke now, you related to the fact that the UN is certainly not a monolithic block, comprises of different mechanisms and different committees and bodies. While the relationship between Israel and the UN as an institution is certainly solid, there's plenty of space to leverage, I think, this relationship to new heights. I think Israel has a lot to gain from the UN and vice versa. What should each of the sides do to strengthen those relations?
Absolutely. I think it's a, and I can't keep saying this enough, I think both the UN and Israel have to benefit from a relationship with each other. I mean, Israel is not just a member state of the United Nations, but I think if you look at very specific areas, if you look at a couple of years ago when the Secretary General visited, we had meetings with quite a lot of startups that were producing very interesting technologies that could be used in by UNHCR in terms of refugee camps, water purifying technologies, telemedicine, agricultural innovations, etc. So there's a benefit in terms of that Israeli society as a whole can provide to how the world tackles global challenges or how it deals with specific challenges on the ground, be they refugees or poverty or any global warming or anything else. And I think there's a vast areas of cooperation there that need to be explored. But there's also a benefit in the and in the other side of the relationship, because if you look at what's happening in Gaza and the West Bank, the UN plays a vital role to support the Palestinian people in terms of their state building, in terms of their institution building, humanitarian development assistance. Both in Gaza and in the West Bank is quite critical. If you take away the perspective of the political perspective of the two-state solution of really resolving this conflict on the basis in which you have Israel and Palestine living side by side in peace and security, that work of the agencies will become close to impossible. And that will increase that would worsen the situation of both Palestinians and Israelis on the ground, and certainly would we not be in the interest of peace. So as much as there's a lot of, as much as some may say this is a love-hate relationship, I don't think, given where the Middle East is, given where the situation here on the ground is, we can do without each other. Mm-hmm. So we're better off working together.
I'll certainly agree to that. You spoke about the West Bank, but I want to take you to Gaza, which I think is a more burning and acute issue, certainly in the lives of many Israelis now. And earlier in May, it was reported that you were in Gaza and, of course, are tirelessly working to help both sides emerge from the current deadlock. My question to you is there a way out of this current paradigm where we see escalation rounds? And what do you think Israel and the international community should do vis-a-vis Gaza?
Yes, I believe there's a way out. It's not an easy way out, but there is one. But first, let me just flag the that, you know, we talk a lot about Gaza and we deal a lot with Gaza right now. I just want to flag an increasing and a growing concern that we have about what's happening in the West Bank, given the financial crisis that the Palestinian Authority is facing, and the risk of a meltdown in the West Bank, which I think would is something that nobody wants to see. I'm just flagging that as something that we will have to get back to soon enough. Gaza is an embarrassment for everyone. I mean, I'm sorry. It's just an embarrassment for embarrassment for Hamas, who've been in control of Gaza for over a decade. It's an embarrassment for Israel because it's just meters away from the highways and the life that Israelis have, and it's an embarrassment for the Palestinian Authority, which has failed to take control back of the situation there. What we've tried to do is to try and focus on three things. Firstly, to try and de-escalate tensions on at the fence, and move away from the cycle of Friday protests where people go out and protest, some get killed, balloons are launched or incendiary devices, attempts to breach the fence happen, the Israeli security forces respond, and you have a lot of potential for incidents and escalation just because of these events. We've tried to work with, and we continue to work with both sides to try and deconflict a little bit that situation and to reduce the tensions. Secondly, to move in with a substantial package of assistance for the people of Gaza to actually alleviate their humanitarian suffering. Until October of last year, they were living with 3 hours of electricity per day. The entire sewage system had stopped functioning. Hospitals were barely functioning. So we've moved in fuel with support from Qatar and created to date over 6,000 temporary jobs. More are to come. Reduce tension at the fence. Increase support the humanitarian situation on the ground, with the hope that by doing these two things, we'll be able to sit down and hammer out a longer term arrangement that addresses the political issues that both Gaza and the Palestinians as a whole face. Now, what I'd like those political issues to be is the, you know, there's a return of unity between the West Bank and Gaza, and in terms of governance structures, etc. That is the goal that we've set ourselves along with our Egyptian partners. We work very closely with Egypt on all of these issues. And ultimately, this means that since the summer of last year, we've ended up in a situation which we've had at least four, if not five now, very serious escalations, which we've had to defuse. The last one was just a couple of weeks ago.
Before the Eurovision Song Contest.
Just before the Eurovision. And I think it was the most dangerous one because of the whole dynamics of it. How do we get out of this deadlock? By really first and foremost creating the space to sit down and actually look for a longer term arrangement. If we continue this cycle in which every week we wonder whether on Friday war is going to break out, we're not going to be able to get anywhere. And this is the positive, perhaps, aspect of this is that maybe contrary to the past, I wasn't here in 2014 and before that, I'd visited, but not in this capacity. Maybe the positive thing is that now nobody in Israel, nobody in Gaza or Egypt has an interest in another war. It still doesn't mean that it's not going to happen.
Exactly. You could have argued that in 2014 as well.
I'm sure you could have argued it in 2014. If it were to happen now, it would be quite devastating and would certainly overshadow what happened in 2014. And I think this would be very, very unfortunate, given where the whole region is with what's happening in Libya, in Syria, in Yemen, in Iraq, the tensions between Saudi and Iran. Certainly this would not be something that would go down well with anyone.
So on this ominous note, let's try and move to hopefully something more positive. I don't know. We'll see where this conversation goes. The U.S. peace plan. So no one really knows anything about the U.S. peace plan yet. We read about it and about its side effects very often. The Israeli press is full of speculations and rumors and commentaries about a plan that no one has literally seen. So my first question to you regarding the U.S. peace plan would be, if the U.S., which is part of the quartet, has presented the peace plan to other members of the quartet, namely, of course, the U.N., Russia and the EU, and if the answer is yes, then what has the reactions to this peace plan been?
That's a very interesting interpretation of a positive note to end the conversation, but no, they haven't. They haven't presented it. I meet quite regularly with the U.S. team at the White House, and we have a good relationship in discussing the situation. I think it's very unfortunate where we are today, where the Americans are actually not in a position to talk to the Palestinians. That relationship has broken down. You can say much about why this is why this has happened, but this is where we are. What we've told American friends consistently is that if they want to put a plan together, it must meet some very basic criteria for it to be credible. This is our advice now. Whether they will hear it or take it on board, I can't say. But firstly, it must be broadly in line with the international consensus of how this issue has to be dealt with and how it has been dealt with until now. Namely, it needs to create a perspective of statehood for the Palestinian people and obviously security for Israel, and an ability to close the final status issues between Israelis and Palestinians as they've been defined in the past. Secondly, it needs to be consulted particularly with partners in the Arab world and in Europe. American partners in the Arab world and Europe, and of course in the rest of the world, but and shared with them, with the quartet, of course, and if they have any comments and if they have any ideas, take on board. So that it doesn't look like a unilateral American initiative, that it looks like something that is inspired and by the United States, because they play a critical role in this, but it is also shared, the responsibility for it is shared a little bit more widely. I think that increases the chances of success. And thirdly, that they shouldn't expect this to be a proposal that is just put on the table and just sits there, but it should be the basis of a negotiation, the basis of something that you can bring both sides together to discuss. Even if there will be disagreements, even if there will be major disagreements and differences, but engaging them, both sides, in a process would be important. Now, how this whole situation unfolds in the coming months, it's difficult to say. I find it that this has all put the United Nations, particularly our mission here, in a unique historical position as being the only ones who are able to speak to everybody, The Americans don't speak to the Palestinians, the Fatah don't speak to Hamas, Egypt doesn't speak to Qatar, the list is long, but we've got to speak to everybody. And this has put us in a sensitive situation, but also quite unique. I don't want to see a situation in which, because a plan is put forward that is rejected by one side, the United States disengages from this region or from this file. It's very important to keep the Americans on board, just as it is important to keep the Europeans and the Russians on board. So we've got a lot of work, I think, over the coming months.
So you certainly speak to everyone, and you mentioned the breaking down of the relations between the United States and the Palestinians. In this vein, what do you say to the Palestinians who are very antagonistic and have already said that they won't come to an economic workshop in Bahrain, and they feel that they're trying to be bought off, paid off?
Well, I've seen the reactions that they've put out in the media, and obviously I think I can predict what they will officially tell us. I'm actually tomorrow I have a couple of meetings with in Ramallah to discuss exactly this. But I spoke to the Bahraini foreign minister a couple of days ago, and he was very clear in our discussions that Bahrain's position in supporting the Palestinian position and Palestine as a whole has not changed. And in terms of two-state outcome on the basis of 67 borders with East Jerusalem as capital. And all that they want to do is actually to create an opportunity for the Americans to present their economic views. But we'll see how reactions in Ramallah are. I think it may be just me, or maybe it's me working for the United Nations, I'm not sure. But I don't think it's good when states don't talk to each other. Whatever the differences are, at least you've got to hear the other side out, present your arguments against if you disagree with them, and have a reasonable discussion. If we all deteriorate to talking to each other through Twitter and Facebook and try and get everything into 120 characters, there's not going to be much of a conversation going on. So we're heading for a few weeks of unclarity as to this political development with this conference that is coming up in Bahrain. But overall, it's against a rather grim backdrop on where Israeli-Palestinian relations are, because there's not much of a peace process these days, if any. There's this complete breakdown of contacts between various sides, and if you've got to stand a chance of succeeding, you've got to start stitching it all back together.
Agreed. So this is now my chance, or at least my way, of trying to end this interview optimistically. And I'll end off with this question, Mr. Mladenov. Do you think that there is a way to emerge from this deadlock, the Israeli-Palestinian deadlock that we have both sides have been contributing to for so many years? And how do we do it? How do we resuscitate the process?
Leadership, one. Generational change, two. Focus more on content than on process, three. Acknowledge that the world around us has changed, and the context of this conflict between Israelis and Palestinians, between Israelis and Arabs in general, is rather different from 10 years ago, from 20 years ago, from 30 years ago, etc. And if we do that, and I believe we can, there's an important role that the international community can play, the UN and others, supporting the leadership on both sides, insulating them from those who will want to disrupt peace talks or to undermine them, creating incentives for economic and others for both sides to re-engage. We just need to think a little bit harder. I fear that in a lot of places around the world, what you say on the Israeli-Palestinian file has just become a standard talking point, perhaps because of the focus on other areas and other conflicts, but this is a reality we need to challenge.
Mr. Mladenov, thank you so very much for contributing to your time to this interview and for speaking to us. Thank you to our listeners, and please join us for more episodes of the INSS podcast series coming soon.